Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm the director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon. This panel is Internet Activism Today, and I'd like to introduce to you Li Tian of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Li Tian is a senior staff attorney and has been involved in a Georgia case, specifically the case of David McGowan. So I'll turn it over to him.
Go ahead. Thanks a lot. Can you hear me? Great. Scott asked me to come today to talk generally about what EFF does, and not just what we do sort of in terms of what issues we cover, but also sort of the nuts and bolts of what someone like me, an EFF attorney, does on a daily basis and how we manage to do it. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to start out by telling you a little bit about who we are and how we got started, and then go into sort of our mission areas and, you know, what I as an attorney do on a daily basis. But we've got about 18 staffers based out of San Francisco, five full-time attorneys, the rest are support staff, admin, that sort of thing. We have about 6,000 members and lots of people who, probably 35 to 40,000 people who subscribe to the Effector, which is our online emailed newsletter, and we have a very, very well-trafficked website. We're primarily known, I think, for our free speech activities, and that's really been sort of our dominant theme, but we were surprised to learn when we started doing statistics on the website that probably more people visit our privacy pages than anything else. But in any case, the free speech issue ends up in everything else we do, whether it's privacy, intellectual property, computer crime, so on and so forth. So, you know, in a way, I guess it's the big sort of picture of what we're trying to do these days is to protect our culture, and especially our technological culture. I mean, if you've ever heard Professor Larry Lessig talk about the intellectual property wars, you know how much the wars over copyright, the DMCA, and all that sort of stuff has to do with whether we control our culture or whether Hollywood and the recording industry and the other copyright owners control it. And that's sort of the big overarching concern, but then, you know, we also have your basic First Amendment issues. We have, and in freedom of speech, it's not just censorship, but we're also concerned about the right of scientists to publish scientific information, source code, to engage in reverse engineering, all these sorts of things. And then, of course, there's the government side of the issue, privacy, which is something that's really become especially important since September 11th. So how did we get started? We were founded in July of 1990, and ironically, in a way, because it is something that we hadn't done a lot of work with up until about 1999, we were started because of a concern about computer crime and the theft of intellectual property. It all came about because of something called, or a group called the New Prometheus League. How many of you have heard of the New Prometheus League? Cool. This is 1990. Apple had proprietary ROMs that somehow were liberated by this group that called themselves the New Prometheus League. And they anonymously sent copies of this alleged Apple code to a whole bunch of people. And Apple, being very upset about it, got the Secret Service involved. And also the FBI. And this was sort of, it's funny because, you know, that's the sort of thing that's happening today, but this is what started us. And two of our founders, Mitch Kaper, who started Lotus, and John Perry Barlow, who was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, independently received visits from the FBI and Secret Service to try to sort of find out what they knew about this, because they had been either received copies of discs or they had been members of the Hackers Conference that is a pretty big deal over in California, which invites a lot of techno-literate people to just sort of talk about and work on and show off cool hacks. Now, both Barlow and Mitch realized very soon after this, their little conversations with the authorities, that there was a problem. The problem was that these law enforcement officers had no clue as to what computer technology was about. They viewed everyone simply as thieves or hackers. They realized that if something wasn't done in some way to oppose this kind of mindset, that we were never going to get off the ground in terms of the potential of computer technology to make a difference for ordinary people. And so they got together with Steve Wozniak, amazingly, of Apple, and John Gilmore, who was like the number five employee at Sun Microsystems, to put together money and start the EFF. And, you know, very quickly after that, they got involved in the issue of computer crime, not just intellectual property stuff, but a sort of hacking thing. And this is actually comes out of this area, because there was a kid named Craig Nydorf who published an electronic magazine called Frack, and he published what was alleged to be internal Bell South documents. And this was in the early days of computer crime. The prosecutors and the government were just, they were really, really anxious to get involved, because they saw that this was something that they could get bureaucratic funding for. This would help them in the turf battles and with other agencies, and you know, it was just something that would be part of a growth industry for them. Well, Nydorf published this article, and he was charged with the interstate transport of stolen property, possible sentence of up to 60 years in jail, and $122,000 in fines. And the Wall Street Journal printed a particularly hysterical article about Nydorf's publication, alleging that this what he published was a computer virus capable of bringing down the entire country's phone system. Well, the fact was that the text file that Nydorf had published simply dealt with bureaucratic procedures for a 911 administration for Bell South. It contained nothing that could be used to crack a system, and in fact, eventually this case was dismissed for this reason. In fact, you could buy this document from Bell South, and it cost a couple of bucks. These guys just were, they had such a hard-on for going after computer crime, they weren't even investigating the facts that were underlying, you know, their allegations. And I mentioned, I place particular emphasis on this today because it sounds a lot like what happened to David McGowan. You know, again, you know, but, you know, from the feds have learned their lesson. They're really not that stupid anymore. But you still have a lot of state and local law enforcement authorities who have not caught up with technology, and they are making the same mistakes. And so we still find ourselves, you know, on an ongoing basis having to deal with these kinds of issues of ignorance, of fear, of hysteria. So in any case, the eventual result of the Nydorf case was the government abandoned its case after 4 days in federal court. They just said, okay, never mind. We made a mistake. So that was our first year, basically, in operation. And we thought from that point on that we would, you know, definitely, we were definitely had a role to play. And since that time, our role has moved more away from computer crime and into the area of free speech. Now I'm going to give you just sort of a real quick menu, as it were, of the kinds of things that we're dealing with today. In the free speech and censorship issue, sex and violence are always the big issues. Anonymity on the internet, we're very, very protective of the right of people to speak on the internet without having to reveal their name. This has turned into a real privacy and surveillance issue because there are so many proposals to track, to trace, to force ISPs to log IP addresses, all this sort of thing. Censorship is not just a government thing, though, these days. A lot of businesses use intellectual property law, in particular, to suppress speech. So we are dealing all the time with cease and desist letters. The most obvious cases are the, you know, blahsucks.com type cases where, you know, companies that don't want to be criticized start going crazy and using something out of ICANN or trademark law or whatever to try to shut someone down. Privacy is another big area for us. I got into working with the EFF about 92, 93 because I was doing crypto work, and I ended up being co-counsel on the, in the case of Bernstein versus the United States, which was a challenge to the cryptography export laws on crypto software. And this was a case which straddled, as so often our cases do, speech and privacy. On the one hand, we wanted to promote crypto so that people would have privacy tools. On the other hand, the basis on which our argument was founded was that when a scientist publishes source code, he's publishing speech. And that's all Professor Bernstein was doing. He was trying to publish something he wanted to publish on Usenet, in fact. But according to the federal law, he needed a license in order to do that. Electronic surveillance. Ever since the Patriot Act in September 11th, we've been very, very active in this area. But even before that, one of our more famous cases was Steve Jackson Games versus the U.S. Secret Service, involving, well, again, this kind of goes back to the Nydorf thing, but the Secret Service thought that the GURPS role-playing system actually was some kind of technical hacker manual. And so in tracing, you know, Frack and Night Lightning and all these people back, they ended up going to Steve Jackson's offices in Texas and seizing a bunch of their servers, which contained contained the BBS, the Illuminati BBS, and you know, a lot of email on it. And so we argued in court that at the very least, the seizure of these emails was something that violated the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The Steve Jackson Games case was sort of a half win, half loss, because we prevailed on the issue of the email seizures violating the ECPA, but we weren't able to get the court to find that it was also an interception under Title III, which, you know, we still today believe that it should have been. Consumer privacy. We don't do a whole lot on consumer privacy as compared to government surveillance. That's just sort of a... There are a lot of groups that do consumer privacy. There are relatively few groups that deal with government surveillance. This is an example of how we have to sort of pick our battles given our limited resources. Since September 11th, the issues have really coalesced around national ID, biometrics, public surveillance, video surveillance with face recognition, all this sort of stuff. We have been recently putting up some new web pages on with a lot of links and information about that. Computer crime, we still do that, but only in a very limited sense, just as Scott was talking about the McCohen case. We don't have any criminal lawyers on our staff. I do computer crime because I know the computer crime statute. I'm familiar with the surveillance laws. There is a lot of stuff that I generally can do to help criminal defense lawyers who don't have any sort of grounding or experience in the internet or internet technology, but my role would usually be very much simply helping explain to them what's going on, helping them see the issues that an ordinary criminal defense lawyer who's been raised on, you know, burglaries and rapes and homicides wouldn't necessarily know when they're facing a, you know, an unauthorized access cause of action. And sometimes our activities are limited to simply getting some kind of media attention. I mean, one thing about EFF is that we are fairly well known, at least among the media. We still are not as well known as we should be among the general public. But, you know, people know, reporters know to call us, and so it's very easy for me to sort of seed the media with stuff about interesting cases and to put out somebody's point of view, to defend someone in the press that might not have a voice otherwise other than on the web. Internet policy, that's something that we do a little bit of. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with all the shenanigans that ICANN's been involved with. What a can of worms, what a mess ICANN is. And it's such a mess that a group like us can't really do very much given how insular and sort of what an old boy network surrounds the whole ICANN problem. And not that we really needed to when John Postel was alive. You know, all that stuff just sort of ran as it should. But things happened when he died at just the wrong time. What we have done, for instance, is we helped represent Carl Auerbach, who's currently one of the ICANN directors, in his lawsuit against ICANN to try to get access to ICANN's corporate records. And Carl had sought some very, very basic accounting records to get an idea of how ICANN was spending its money on lawyers and whatnot, and they simply refused. I mean, this is actually a pure issue of corporate law, because directors are supposed to be able to see the books. They're supposed to be able to see the records. That is just the law in virtually in every state in the country. But ICANN was an arrogant bunch of bastards, and they said, no, they're not going to do it. They were putting all sorts of conditions on it. And, you know, finally we ended up having to sue in order to vindicate his rights. And sort of surprisingly, because even though we knew we were right, we sort of expected that it would be harder for the court to rule for us simply because they were represented by some very, very high-powered law firms. But we won a pretty clear victory in court a few months ago, and they're now handing over the records to Carl. And then the last big area that we're dealing with, and this is what I started talking about, is IP. I mean, intellectual property is such a huge area for us right now. Of our five lawyers right now, three do almost nothing but IP-related issues, from fair use to reverse engineering and whatnot. And even I do IP stuff when it's linked to speech. For instance, the ability of scientists to publish works about security vulnerabilities that affect encryption or other technological protection measures under the DMCA. Another area that has grown in the last year or two, the international. For the first many years of EFF's existence, we were mostly dealing with U.S. law. I mean, because this is where the internet really took off. This is where so many users are. U.S. law has been the big thing. But since the Yahoo case involving the French groups suing Yahoo over its selling at an auction site Nazi memorabilia, which runs afoul of the laws against the selling of Nazi memorabilia and other sorts of Nazi publications in France, and they were getting this too, they sued and they won in France, forcing Yahoo to take down all sorts of Nazi-related stuff on the Yahoo France site. But what about the Yahoo US site? Who has jurisdiction? Does a French court have the power, the right to tell a US web server located in, Northern California, what it can or cannot publish, simply because it's accessible to French citizens. I mean, that's the big issue there. Then another issue has to do with forum shopping because of libel and defamation lawsuits. And we handled a case called Narco News, where a Mexican journalist was sued for libel in New York by the Bank of Mexico, which isn't really in New York. And, you know, we wrote an amicus brief saying, well, you know, this is the dispute between a Mexican bank and a Mexican